Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:10 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time, Standard Time. Today is January 6th. I thought we'd kick off today and look at the three-month Treasury note because it's trading at 1.52%. There's a little bit of evidence that we're getting some steadying in the region of that psychological 1.5% level. But I think the bigger picture here is that when we look at the Fed funds rate, it's at 1.75%. And what that suggests is the bond market doesn't have a great deal of credible or doesn't really believe that the Fed is not going to cut rates. Part of the reason for that is because of the mismatch that we've had in the repo facility. Then there's also the fact that the Federal Reserve has been adding money into its balance sheet at an incredibly aggressive rate, going from 3.75 trillion to 4.17 since the beginning of September is an aggressive monetary stimulus, any way you want to cut it. Regardless of where the money is in fact ending up, whether it is in the Treasury itself in order to fund the deficit, whether it is in terms of excess reserves sitting on banks, whether it's within the repo market itself to allow for additional liquidity to flow. The reality is that the Federal Reserve is now both the last and first supplier of liquidity to the repo market. The repo market funds the global carry trade. The global carry trade is one of the greatest sources of speculative funds to fuel speculation in a whole host of asset classes. Therefore, it's imperative that we do have a liquid repo market. Well, I've been saying now for the last couple of weeks that regardless of whether the Fed has in fact announced that they have a standing repo facility or not, the de facto reality is that that's exactly what they've done. They have put the strength of the Fed's balance sheet behind the repo market. Now, I think it's important to consider just how wide how big the balance sheet of the Fed could potentially go. We know what happened with the ECB. They took €1 trillion out of circulation and had to put back in 2.6 just come back to level. Well, the Federal Reserve took approximately $750 billion out of circulation. Well, that would suggest that they're probably going to have to put in $2 trillion to get back to level. Well, considering the response that we've had from asset prices to this acute move and the valuations at which this stimulus is occurring, we have the conditions for a bubble. One of the things that I find quite interesting is when you look through the 2020 prognostications for the vast majority of asset managers, they're looking at valuation expansion that happened in 2019, and they're concluding that 2020 won't be as impressive on the upside as 2019 was unless we have a significant pump up in terms of corporate profitability and earnings. But one thing that they seem to be ignoring is that the valuation expansion that we had in 2019 followed the valuation contraction that we had in 2018. And valuations are pretty much back now to where they were at the beginning of 2018. Corporate profits have been going sideways now for much of the last 5 years. This isn't a measure that's updated with a great deal of regularity, but it has been certainly range-bound since 2012, and well, that's really 7 years, isn't it? But the pause in corporate profits has done nothing to arrest the continued rise of the stock market. Something has to be fueling that rise in the stock market. Well, one might say if it isn't corporate profitability, it's the corporate profits of a small number of companies, like the FANG stocks, and they continued to impress on the upside. The NASDAQ was, in fact, reversed an earlier decline in here today. And this looks like rather odd action to say that we had three white candles, but two lower opens. Well, what that suggests is that there has certainly been some reticence to continue to pay new highs in the morning because of worries overnight about the assassination of a prime Iranian general target in Iraq, and then the potential that Iran is going to strike back. Then yesterday we had President Trump saying that if Iran strikes back at the USA, then they will get a disproportionate response. So that is certainly upping the ante in terms of geopolitical considerations. But I think the biggest lessons that David always tended to talk about in these periods of stress is monetary policy beats most other factors most of the time, and a crisis has to be seen to be getting worse in order for it to have a deleterious effect on prices, and that the trend of that crisis has to be getting progressively worse in order for it to continue to have a deleterious effect on prices. And so far, it's not getting demonstrably worse. Of course, there is the potential that it will get demonstrably worse. We just don't know what the potential is. So this is a rather tense environment. It certainly led to a pop on the upside for gold prices early in the session, but as the pullback on the stock market reversed, then some of the speculative interest in gold started to wane, and it gave up the majority of its advance by the close. Gold has rallied rather impressively from the lows around $1,450, and I think we are now probably due some consolidation. The fact that silver also pulled back from its intraday high suggests that there is a likelihood we're going to see some consolidation, but I think it's rather important to highlight that silver broke its downtrend, gold pushed on to a new high, platinum, however, did get up to test the $1,000 level and failed to sustain that, to sustain a move above it. I think we're likely to get some consolidation. I think that's by far the most likely set of circumstances. But I don't suspect that it's going to be anything other than a consolidation. When we look at the longer term trends, this continues to look like a first step above the almost year-long base formation. And we know that $1,000 is a big psychological level and has represented an area of resistance on multiple occasions over the last 3 years. When it's eventually resolved on the upside, I think then we're in blue sky territory for platinum, but we're just not there yet. Silver prices are, I think, really very similar. The $20 area has been an area of resistance since 2014, and it hasn't even quite been able to get up to that region on this particular rally, but and I think we are probably due a little bit of additional consolidation. It's probably going to represent an additional buying opportunity, but it's more likely than not that silver will be pushing on the upside over the medium term. What this also suggests is we're probably going to see some consolidation in terms of the gold miners. They are right in the region of the upper side of a 7-year range, and there is also the scope for some consolidation, but it doesn't really look like we're going to get much more than that. What we are starting to see, however, is that gold miners are responding to the higher price environment for the gold metal and increasing their dividends. So when we look at the dividend growth in some of the gold miners, it's really quite impressive. While the absolute yield itself is quite low, the dividend growth rate is really very impressive. This is, I think, an additional point when we look at, for example, Visa. Visa pushed onto new high ground last week. It's consolidating right now. It's been in an incredibly impressive bull market for just about all of the last decade. The dividend has been increased substantially and in the order of 20% per year every year since the IPO, but the yield is only about 0.63%. Of course, that yield compounds, and the yield that one attains because of the dividend growth improves every year after owning it. And I think that that kind of valuation metric is going to start to become very relevant in the gold mining sector. A substantial number of those gold miners promised during the bear market that they were going to concentrate on free cash flow, that they were going to link their dividends to the gold price. That was certainly the case for Newmont. It was also the case for Sibanye-Gold, and that share has done nothing but rise since late 2018. It's up almost five times. So they have not yet reinstituted their dividend. They've been very aggressive in terms of M&A activity. They're certainly benefiting from the continued rise in palladium prices. And that is also true of a number of the other platinum producers, because palladium is a byproduct of platinum mining. But I think we can also say that considering the fact that the price is north of $10 and the moving average is around $560, that we have a wide overextension. There's been an incredible acceleration. We're probably due some consolidation, but there's no real sign yet that this advance is over, and not least as palladium prices test the $2,000 level. And again, there is no real sign of a pause in this continued and incredibly impressive advance for palladium. Well, when we then think about, well, what is going on in terms of oil prices? It was up over a dollar in early trading, but it reversed intraday. The reality is that the higher the price goes, the more supply is eligible for production. And this is the point that I think people still don't really understand about the shale properties. They have ample supply, but they need to be able to hedge their production at attractive levels in order to spend or go out and borrow the money to drill the wells. And when prices are not accommodative, then they won't spend. So linking oil sector spending to an outlook for the wider market just does not make sense, because it's completely tied to the price environment. When prices rise, then spending increases. This is not exactly the same as the kind of condition we would have had previously. This is completely different. The elasticity of supply to price is one of the most profound changes that we've had in the energy sector, and it is one of the contributing factors to the game-changing nature of shale oil and gas. So we would need to see clear evidence of supply disruptions in order for oil prices to be sustained at high levels. And then as soon as high levels are attained, and I don't consider $70 to be high, but rather more like $80, then you're going to see a supply response. This is the condition that we're seeing evolve in the energy sector because of unconventional oil and gas. Of course, because we have a an environment where a lot of the conventional suppliers have been in downtrends for a prolonged period, well, they do have the potential to unwind their oversold conditions, and Occidental Petroleum has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs that's been in evidence for over 18 months. This is a rather profound move for one of the worst performing shares of 2019, but it's also representative of the kind of reversals we get for at the beginning of the year for some of the most heavily shorted shares. When we then look a little bit wider at the outlook for the industrial metals, then what we're presented with here with copper is still a ranging environment, but it looks increasingly like a recovery scenario, and the price continues to push back up towards the upper side of this range that's persisted for the last 18 months. It's going to have to sustain a move above $3 in order to really confirm that we're back in a demand-dominated environment, but I think that is or at least a test of the $3 area is looking more likely than not. The equal weighted continuous commodity index continues to push up towards the upper side of its 4-year range. The outlook for commodities is going to be heavily influenced by what happens in China. The stock market there was pretty much unchanged in here today, but at least it is holding the move up and out of the range that persisted for most of the latter half of 2019. The Indian market is obviously very susceptible to any concerns about higher oil prices, and the market was down in a dynamic manner in here today. There is a somewhat overbought condition, so we may see some additional consolidation. One of the hallmarks of the trend over the last 2 years has been the failure to sustain upward breaks. Meanwhile, the progression of higher reaction lows has continued to hold. What that suggests is we may be in for some additional, a somewhat larger pullback. But of course, the Indian market closed early today, and the reversal that we saw on Wall Street could help to support the market. And I think that's equally true when we look at the wider market. When, for example, we look at the performance on in Europe relative to Wall Street, the majority of European indices were in negative territory, but they did pair their declines intraday. So, for example, when we look at the FTSE 250 index, it was in negative territory. Again, I think it's quite clear that we do have overbought conditions. I think it is quite likely that at least some of these are going to be unwound. I think it's also worth highlighting that a company like Advanced Micro Devices is trading at a premium to the trend mean of almost 50%, and that is a condition that is not going to last indefinitely. So far, there has been a distinct absence of downward dynamics, but the first downward dynamic is likely to mark a peak of at least near-term significance. What I think we are looking at is at a very clear supply, money supply dominated environment, which is likely to boost asset prices generally for the majority of 2020. There is this uncertainty about what's going to happen in terms of the Middle East, the relationship between the USA and some of its allies and some of its enemies, and what kind of environment is eventually going to evolve. It's certainly the trend of greater geopolitical trouble doesn't appear to be improving. But the hiatus in the trade war is a bonus at the very minimum. Then, of course, you have the clear conclusion that the USA is now an energy exporter. And that changes the calculation about just what it can do with regard to the Middle East if it's no longer subject to the kind of pressure from higher oil prices that it once would have been. Of course, Europe is still highly constrained by energy prices. The Euro Stoxx index, though, is still holding its move above 400. And I do think that we are likely to see Europe playing catch up. The reality is, if we are in a global reflationary trade, and I think that that is the base case, then it is likely that Europe can play catch up simply because of the valuation discount and the leverage to the global economy that a number of the European countries have. I thought it was interesting in here today that German automotive production was the lowest in years, and yet the DAX index was able to hold onto the lower side of this range. I think this is an example of the kind of consolidation we can expect from most other markets, where I think it's not much more than a consolidation to unwind the oversold conditions, the overbought conditions, excuse me. Then, when we look at the 10-year Treasury yield, it was in somewhat more positive territory in here today, and it continues to hold the sequence of higher reaction lows. The one thing that we can conclude with the Fed funds rate at 1.75% and the 10-year yield at 1.8% is that the bond market has absolutely no credibility in any kind of inflationary argument. That is rather interesting. It suggests that bond investors continue to think that the case for global reflation is not quite yet well made. They continue to think that the Federal Reserve will have to cut interest rates. They have been sufficiently chastened by the illiquidity evolving in the repo market to suggest that, or to, at least for them to hold on to their conviction that we're still in a rather deflationary environment. Bill Dudley today talking about a standing repo facility suggests that there is likely to be at least a discussion in the Fed about whether that should be formally announced, but the reality is we've already got it. In many respects, the whole debate about modern monetary theory is equally academic. We've already got it. The reality is that the Federal Reserve is enabling the incredible deficits that the federal government is running. And this is not really that new when we look at the persistence and consistency of the US presidential cycle. We've already had ample evidence of cooperation between the monetary and fiscal authorities on a periodic calendar-based system. And modern monetary theory, it would be simply formalizing that relationship. So the reality is we're already in a modern monetary theory environment. That's one of the reasons why gold is firm, not just over the last week, but over the last year. The realization that investors are looking for some form of hedge, that they are looking at the combined global monetary and fiscal stimulus and concluding that yes, that is going to contribute to asset price inflation and that it is likely to be positive for nominal stock prices and asset prices, but that it is going to come at the expense of purchasing power of fiat currencies. That's one of the reasons why gold remains firm. And it's also, I think, the argument for why having some weighting in the precious metal after what has been a really quite lengthy hiatus is looking more convincing. And I think with that, I'll leave you for today and wish all the best to all of you.